Okay, it's the 18th of February, 1997, and we're at the medical school library at the Tufts University School of Medicine in Boston, Massachusetts, with Jerry Faust for the Pew Scholars Program in the Biomedical Sciences Oral History and Archive Project. And the Pew Trust have provided us with this terrific opportunity to create a record of the process and conduct of science and scientific discovery among young investigators, the Pew Scholars. And over the course of the next three sessions, we would like to cover three areas. Early background, the second area would be developing scientific interests and your current scientific program, and the issues affecting scientific community today, broader issues affecting the scientific community today. So to begin with, I'd like to ask when and where you were born, and perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your family background as well.
Okay. I was born in 1950 in Sterrett, Texas. It's a small town about halfway between Dallas and Waco.
Okay.
My mother was a registered nurse, and my father was a farmer at that time. However, my parents separated and finally divorced about the time that I started junior high school, and at that time, my brother and I and my mother moved to Dallas, where I went to junior high school and high school. So, I guess my background is pretty nondescript for someone who started out on a farm and had some of the typical experiences, mostly unrelated to sophisticated science. But then when I look back on it, there was some interesting biology going on, as most people would witness from a farm. But I think the first type of exposure to, quote, modern-day science appeared in the eighth grade. So I was fortunate to be in a science and math honors program. I had good grades in those particular courses and not so good in other courses. And in the eighth grade, I took ninth grade biology, which was just an advanced level course. And there was an article that had appeared in, I think it was Time, no, it wasn't Time, it was Look or Life, about the discovery of a new molecule within cells that had enormous ramifications on cell metabolism. And that molecule was ATP, adenosine triphosphate. So actually, I think it was a series of articles. So my biology teacher made copies of those articles and distributed, and we spent about 3 or 4 days talking about ATP. So this was a little bit hard to fathom, because at that point biology was animals and plants and occasionally an organ, you know, like a heart or some part of a salamander that we dissected, or a leaf, and who all of a sudden begin to think about what was inside of the organ or the cells was kind of a new experience. And that was really about all I saw to the inside of cells for a long time, because I left biology, so to speak, and when I went on to high school, then still being part of a science honors program, I took chemistry. And really kind of fastened myself to the physical sciences, like chemistry and physics, more so than biology. I guess as we get older and gain more knowledge, then it's easier to grasp on to the new stuff that amazes you than it is to remember some of our old fondnesses or remembrances about that excitement in the 8th grade versus that excitement in the 10th grade. But another, I liked chemistry. I had all that magic to go with things that happen and changing colors and producing gases and explaining a lot of what we were seeing as we moved closer to the 20th century. You know, that DuPont's motto was better living through chemistry.
Yeah, right.
It was certainly at that time true. All the new things that were being produced and as a result of synthetic chemistry. And then I was fortunate in that, I forgot now, what did I take in the ninth grade? If I took biology in the eighth grade, what did did I take any science in the ninth grade? Because it wasn't until I got to high school that I went into chemistry. Anyway, so but my high school chemistry teacher at the end of the sophomore year asked me to go with him to a symposium that was being held at the University of Texas in Austin, specifically for high school students to get them acquainted with advances in science. And although I hadn't had any physics at that time, this particular symposium was geared towards high school students, and it dealt with discussions and distribution of the technology and knowledge associated with fusion versus fission as a means of making energy. So, you know, we heard talks from eminent physicists who I didn't know, and then we saw laboratories, and then we spent 3 days and two nights wandering around on this enormous educational complex, which was a far cry from W.H. Adamson High School in Stare, Texas. And then we even went into the physics buildings and walked through the laboratories where graduate students, I suspect, and postdocs and faculty were doing experiments. So even though I had read about people who were working in that kind of environment and had a mind's eye view of what went on in research laboratories, you know, what did people do and how did they react and what did they look like and did they all wear lab coats? I'd never been in one or a building that did that stuff on every floor in every room. So that was really amazed me. Set me to thinking, you know, about that these things really exist and that there are whole groups of people that do this kind of stuff for a living. And the opportunity to just walk through there for a few hours in my life I think had a significant impact on saying, well, you know, these opportunities exist for people, research, whether it's nuclear physics or chemistry or biology or what have you. And then I think the chemistry teacher was a role model for me. At that time, I was not associated with my father, so I didn't have my mother and my brother, and I didn't have any male role models. And he was a good guy. And he was also an assistant basketball coach, and I played basketball, so that elevated his status in my mind. So here was a chemistry teacher who was a basketball coach. And he, I think, did a lot to not only taking me on that excursion to UT, but motivating me to look at opportunities and all sorts of endeavors, whether it's chemistry or biology or physics. So I think those, and then the rest of high school was just kind of nondescript. I mean, you know, I got into the being a high school student and a basketball player and all that other stuff that goes along with it. So you really don't think much, or I'll take that back. I'm sure a lot of people, especially in this part of the country, kids think about, you know, what they're going to do when they get past 18. You know, what colleges are they going to go to? What are they going to do after college? You know, whether they're going to go to med school or vet school or going to be law school, or are they going to go into business or whatever? And quite frankly, I didn't give it a single thought. Up until, you know, well into my senior year, I really didn't have much aspirations to go to college, but I didn't know what else I was going to do either. So yeah, that part of the country is a little bit different from as I've been around a little bit more now in the expectations for even middle class people, especially back in the 60s and late 70s. I mean, there was a lot going on in the country with youth and young adults. You know, the war had an incredible impact, certainly on men, or young men, and I suspect in women too. But there just wasn't much talk about going to college or what we wanted to do or anything like that.
But you did have an idea that if you said, oh, I want to grow up and be a scientist, you had an idea of what a scientist did?
Mm-hmm. That's it.
Because of that, because of this one trip, or had you before that, had you had that, your mother being an RN?
She was an RN, and I had been around hospitals and been not in operating rooms, but just as if you would go visit a sick friend. You know, occasionally I'd go visit my mother or so. So in the on the wards or in the hospital rooms, but never to the, say, the inner workings of a hospital. And these were smaller hospitals, so they didn't have any research lab. They had clinical labs, but I don't think I ever went in one of those. But I think you're right in that one trip just showed me physically and tangibly that research goes on and what the people look like. Not that they're any different than anybody else, but kind of had a feel for, or better focused a picture about how their life works in a professional setting. Whereas that's easily obtained for people every day, if you're looking at lawyers or policemen or sales clerks or insurance agents or what. I mean, we encounter these people every day. And allow me to ramble on a little bit more. I think that's what I'm leading up to is that one of the problems, I think, with our profession is that we don't have the opportunity, or we don't provide ourselves with the opportunity to let other people in different aspects of our society see us and on a day-to-day basis, and to know what we do. I have some very educated friends who I deal with different times of the year, and lawyers and even doctors that still think that I wear a white coat every day and I have goggles on and I go off into a laboratory and actually do experiments, and all that's not even true. I don't wear a white coat. I don't do many experiments these days, and I don't wear goggles. But I think that's, you know, they just don't have an idea about what goes on day to day in a research laboratory. So that experience at UT gave me that kind of opportunity to see and to realize and to think about placing myself possibly in that situation later down the line.
And why do you think, this is jumping ahead a bit, but why do you think that's there is not this public conception of a scientist?
Yeah, I've thought about that for a while too, every time I bring this up in my mind. And I suspect maybe a little bit's got to do with old fiction, you know, about scientists and Dr. Frankenstein, and mm-hmm. and maybe science fiction, and as it was created, has allowed society to say, okay, it's acceptable that we don't know what these people do because, you know, it may not all be good, or it may be too confusing. We may not understand it. It's okay that we don't try to understand. Whereas we need to know to a certain extent what a lawyer does, because he may become a politician. We have better insight. Or a doctor, because we deal with these people every day. So we need to have a kind of a conceptual framework about what their thinking is and what they're saying and how they work in order for us to understand what they're trying to tell us. But there is no real need, I guess, for society to understand what we do, and because they don't really communicate with us. That's about the only, it's a poor excuse, but that's about the only thing I can come up with is why we don't portray ourselves in a right. more user-friendly manner. it's not that, we're looked down upon. It's just that, I think people would appreciate us much more. Not, once again, not that science and biomedical science is not appreciated as it is, but if you become familiar with a topic or a discipline or an individual in his profession, then you can understand what he's trying to do much better, and you can see where criticize him in a more critical fashion. And I once again appreciate his contributions and sometimes his pitfalls.
Okay, and where, one last question here is, where then should the burden lie? Should it the public, is it the public's, should it be the public's initiative to try and build a better understanding or as bridge to scientists, or should the scientists take up the initiative and try to, you know, where does this kind of middle ground come from to have a more public understanding of something more of the science? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think clearly it has to come from our end of the field. I mean, we have to take measures to make ourselves more public. The public's not going to do that, at least at this time. Who knows? Things may change, but it's the onus is on the scientific community to try and make itself more public friendly and more and make the public more aware of what we're doing and why we're doing it. What the goals are. So how we go about doing that is is certainly open for discussion, but I think there's always some constant movement in that direction.
Okay. Well, to go back to some things you said about expectations and expectations in your part of the world, but to go back to that, how big was Sterrett, the town you grew up in? How do you spell that? Is that like one of those Texas German named towns?
Well, yes. There was a large immigration of Germans that came to Texas in the middle of the 19th century, of which ancestry were part of. And the bulk of them settled in the Texas Hill Country, which is west of San Antonio in Austin.
Right.
And Fredericksburg and Bourne and New Braunfels. And that's where his people came. But Sterrett is a little bit north of there. It's in central Texas. But a good bit of Germans settled there also, as well as some other immigrants from Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia. Not in the numbers like the Deutschmen, but there were quite a bit. And so there's Flatonia and Hasak or other small towns in that same area. But Sterrett is about population about 250, 300, I guess now. It never has grown. I mean, most of the people left the black land, you know, when farming kind of got out of vogue. Actually, there was an opportunity to revive the town when the super collider was going to be built. This was actually in Waxahachie, which is north of Sterrett, but it would provide a tremendous economic boom to that part of central Texas, south of Dallas and Fort Worth. That project folded, of course, and so people haven't moved back to Sterrett. I think the numbers have just stayed the same. So the answer to your question is that it's about 250, 300 at this time,
yeah.
Very, very small town. And then when we moved into Dallas, Dallas was still a small. That small town feel to it, even in the 60s and 70s. It was only about 500,000. And then we lived in a part of Dallas called Oak Cliff. Two words, Oak Cliff. So it was on a cliff that overlooked the Trinity River. And that was an even more countrified part of Dallas compared to across the river in North Dallas, which was more city-like. So even within the so it's sort of like, I don't know the suburbs of Los Angeles, but I'm trying to make a comparison here. Let's just say that it was less cosmopolitan in Oak Cliff than it was in Dallas, and so it wasn't that much of a step towards real big city living to go from Sterrett to Oak Cliff. There was only two high schools in Oak Cliff, and you know, it was still pretty small.
Was there a grammar school in Sterrett?
Yes.
Yeah.
There was a grammar school.
How many kids were in this?
Well, there was one class, and so my brother's 2 years older than I am, and I think the classes were roughly about 20, 22, something like that. And the same class went all the way through to See, I left in the sixth grade, or at the end of the sixth grade, moved to Dallas, and then went to junior high. And there were 3 seventh grade classes, and I was in one of them.
So, in relative terms, that was probably kind of moving, your horizons were changing.
And yes, very much so.
Well, what kind of farming did your dad do?
He was a blackland farmer, cotton. And then a little bit of corn, and then like all farmers, then we also had a couple of horses that provided more or less entertainment than anything else. I mean, no one pulled a plow by horsing at that time, even in Sterrett. And there were always a couple of pigs running around and chickens and that kind of stuff, that animal life that taught us some things about biology.
So I imagine your chores, your daily chores, were involved a little bit more than just taking out the trash.
Right. So I was pretty much in charge of small animals, like chickens and pigs. And my brother handled the cows. And as we both grew older, then we kind of shared responsibility for horses. And taking care of them, grooming them, feeding them, watering.
Yeah. Well, farming isn't an easy profession. How successful was your father at farming?
Not very successful. It's hard to do on small acreage. Mm-hmm. Or that's, I'm told, still the explanation for the collapse of the family farm. Mm-hmm. It's these large corporate farms that can buy at lower cost and labor, and then take care of their labor responsibilities with the less outlay, that are successful. And the other important thing is, in farming, like most other things connected with nature, there are good years and bad years. And so it's important to be able to either hedge your bets through futures trading or insurance or the like, to kind of even out the peaks and the valleys. And that's just impossible for a small-scale farmer to do that kind of stuff. So I think as I go back and visit Texas now, that most of the people who live in the agricultural part of Texas that are not part of large aggregates are not even working the land. They're employed at some other profession or jobs that are not directly related to agriculture, whether it's driving a school bus, or running a mechanic shop, or being an insurance agent, or what, and maybe they're just kind of piddling on the side as a hobby, running some horses or running some cows or the like.
Yeah. Well, had your dad gone to college?
No.
And I take it your mother, though, with her nursing degree, had gone to college.
Right. I guess I'm not sure exactly. Well, nursing school was not really college. It was that. It was a professional school, so I think after she graduated from high school, my father didn't graduate from high school, but after she graduated from high school, I think she's originally from Indiana.
Okay.
And she went to nursing school for 3 years and became a registered nurse, a degree, well, I don't know if it's a degree, but just a certified registered nurse, and has a nursing degree. So maybe that's equivalent to dental hygienist or something.
Yeah.
I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think schools do offer bachelor's degrees in nursing now, but they may have at that time, but she didn't have one. Mm-hmm. She went to Indiana University Nursing School, I think.
And how did she find Sterrett, Texas?
After she graduated from nursing school, she wanted to travel. So she actually spent a winter here in Boston, and then a year in New York City, and then I think she went spent some time in the Midwest again, and then finally ended up in Los Angeles. And my father was vacationing out there, and they met and fell in love, and they must have stayed in Los Angeles a good bit of time, either that or they had a short courtship, because they moved back. She moved with him back to Texas, and he was living in Ellis County at that time.
And is your dad a Texan from a long ways back?
Yes, his I think his great grandfather came from a region in Germany that my brother actually visited when he was in the army, but I can't remember where it is. Yeah, but those people settled down in the hill country there. In fact, I still have some distant third, fourth, fifth cousins or something that live in the Comfort area, and there's a landmark there, an old mid 19th century hotel called the Faust Hotel. So that we can trace our name back to.
Yeah. Well, I remember driving from San Antonio to Austin and seeing, well, I would have pronounced it Grün, but they pronounce it Green in Texas, but right. It's spelled like you would say Green in German.
Right, that's it, the Germans would say Grün.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And was your dad born in the same town?
No, he was born in... I think it was outside of Comfort, a little farm between Comfort and Kerrville, but it didn't have a name associated with it, and had just moved on to stare it to better farming lands, potentially. You know, there's not a whole lot of farming in the hill country. It's pretty rocky. All it's good for is running goats and hunting. There's a lot of deer down there, and fishing on the Guadalupe. So
floated down the Guadalupe on an inner tube.
Yeah, and do brownfields?
A little bit further up.
Okay, it's.
I think, but it was on the Guadalupe.
Yeah. So there wasn't much farming activity there, and then usually when there's not much farming and you have large families, so there was. See, he had two sisters and three brothers. Then, as the family grows, somebody's going to have to leave in order to maintain the same amount of survival for the ones that are remaining.
Yeah, and they were all farmers as well, or married to farmers?
Well, he has one sister, and she actually moved to Washington. I can't remember how she married my uncle, and she, in the Seattle area, and lived most of her life up there, and now she's still living, but has retired to Arizona. And then another sister stayed there in the area and finally moved into San Antonio and married, and is no longer alive. And let's see, the brothers, one moved to Louisiana and into the Alexander area, worked as a salesman, and is no longer alive. And the other one was a pharmacist in Arkansas, went to pharmacy school. Actually, I don't even think he went to pharmacy school. I think in Arkansas, you could, at that time, let's just say in the 1930s or 40s, you could just hang up a shingle in Arkansas and say that you're going to dispense drugs, which probably isn't that much different nowadays. So he was in the Hot Springs area, and he was no longer alive.
Yeah. And was there a hospital, or did your mom work when you were growing up?
Yes, she actually drove into Dallas and worked as a hospital when that work was available. But most of her jobs were what's called private duty, in which she would go to someone's home on during the day for, say, I guess the shifts were 7 to 3 or oftentimes 3 to 11, and take care of patients in their home. So that she could do in and around Central Texas there, was driving around and doing that. And then we moved into Dallas. Then she was sort of an independent contractor, was still a private duty nurse, but would work out of certain hospitals. So a patient would contract a private duty nurse to come and be her nurse at Methodist Hospital or Parkland Hospital. But mother wasn't paid by the hospital. She was paid by the patients or their insurance company. And that was a little bit archaic because she didn't have any benefits, which I didn't realize until I got older what benefits really were, you know. But, you know, that's important. She never paid Social Security at that time, or she had no health insurance herself, and she had to file her own income tax. And it wasn't until she later kind of gave up the private duty practice and began to take jobs in hospitals that would retain a nursing staff that she could begin to accumulate Social Security payments that have, you know, helped her a lot in her retirement. She's still alive and drawing on those payments. So it was kind of a, like I said, independent contractor at that time.
Well, when you were younger and your parents were still together, I would suspect that your dad didn't have benefits or any. And how did they get through the kind of traditional childhood accidents and broken bones?
Well, I guess they paid for it themselves. Mm-hmm. When I look back on it, I never really haven't thought much about it. I've never had a broken bone though, so I've been pretty luckily accident free. And you know, I mean, measles and chickenpox. I never had mumps. My brother had mumps, but there weren't. I guess in retrospect, there weren't a lot of medical expenses paid for our keeping. You know, mother was there to if we got a big gash to stitch us up, and if we were ill, then she took care of us rather than, you know, having to put us in a car and take us to an MD who would make some kind of diagnosis, which was probably pretty routine for a childhood disease,
right,
and then charge you whatever it was at that time. So just her profession allowed us to cut costs there. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we grew a lot of our own food. We had year-round gardens most of the time in Texas, and there was plenty of meat available. So there wasn't a lot. It certainly cut back on amount of money that went into that end of the budget.
Right.
But we were always not, I wouldn't say dirt poor. There was always enough food around, but we always watched, you know, what we did with the money, or my parents watched what they did with the money. And my mother, up until the time that she was not able to take care of her finances anymore, still did that. She was an incredibly frugal person. Even sometimes it was almost embarrassing or even pathologic to that standpoint. But she is still living off of her funds, and she's been in a nursing care center since 1993 that costs roughly about $2,500 a month. So I have direct responsibility for her financial affairs, and it's just amazing to me that someone who didn't have that much earning potential has accumulated that kind of wealth, that she is not a burden to myself and my brother.
Yeah.
And she's getting excellent care. Damn well ought to be at $2,500 a month.
Yeah.
But, you know, that much better than what he could provide or I could provide.
She's still in Texas?
Yes. She's living in a nursing care center in Dallas. We moved her up. So, ironically, when I left high school, she left Dallas also because my brother was in the Army. And she moved to a small town out in West Texas called Seymour, which is out west of Wichita Falls. All right. And this was about the time she realized she wasn't accumulating retirement or Social Security benefits, and so she took the job as director of nurses at Baylor County Hospital in Seymour, Texas. Now, to put it in perspective, Seymour had a population of about 800, but it had its own, but it was the county seat. I mean, people were kind of few and far between out in West Texas. So it was a county seat, and it had a hospital, you know, maybe 15 beds. But if you've got a hospital, you've got to have a director of nurses, you know. So this was a salaried position with, you know, insurance right there at the hospital, health insurance, of course, and they paid Social Security, and there was a little bit of retirement. And so she went out there and worked all the time that I was in college, and even longer than that. I think she stayed there for about 6 years. And then she took a similar position at Kerrville, became director of nurses at the Kerr County Hospital, which is the which houses Kerrville is the county seat, a little bit larger. And the Kerrville, I mean, the population kind of swells and ebbs according to the hunting season. So in the fall, when it's legal to shoot deer in Texas, it could get up as high as about $11,000 or 11,000 inhabitants. And then in the winter, when there's not much else going on, it could probably drop to about 2,000. So it's a pretty good size town and a lovely part of the state. So she worked there for a good many years, and then finally I even gave up her job as director and went back to part-time or working part duty, private duty, and then even part-time, and she retired in Kerrville. And finally she got to the point where she could no longer live by herself, and in 1993 my brother and I moved her to a nursing care center in Dallas. He lives between Dallas and Fort Worth and Arlington, to where he could kind of help look after her. And she's been there since 93.
Yeah.
She's 88.
Wow.
I know.
Yeah. And did your, after you and your brother and mother moved to Dallas, did your dad still continue to farm?
No, no. He moved to Dallas also. We kind of gave it all up. And then he took a job as a salesman selling produce, fruits and vegetables, for a company in the Dallas area. And it was traveling mostly around to grocery stores and restaurants and filling and meeting their needs. Mm-hmm. And worked there for the rest of his life. And then actually remarried. And had a very good life. Retired in Dallas and died about 12 years ago.
Well, what kind of expectations did your mother and your father have for you and your brother in terms of, like, what you're going to do when you grow up?
Well, I don't think there were any expectations in terms of what professions we should pursue, but there was expectations that we do our schoolwork. When we got home from school, we had to have the homework done before we went out to play. And, you know, grades were important, that we bring home good grades. I don't remember ever being criticized for a bad grade, but there was a lot of praise for good grades, and that both of them, especially my mother, I think, knew the value of a good education, whether even if you're going to stay a farmer. So I think they just wanted us to do well in school, and that would open doors that we could possibly walk through with our own 2 feet.
And within your family, were there expectations that you might go to college?
No. My brother went into the Army, and then with the incentive of the GI Bill, so this was right around Vietnam, but he's about 6'7" and weighs about 250. Thank God the Army realized that he would not survive long in the jungles of the Vietnamese peninsula. So they made him an MP and sent him to Germany.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So when he got out, he through the GI Bill, went to school for a while at Texas A&M. But was not successful and never finished. I think he stayed down there on and off about 3 years, but how many hours he's got accumulated towards a baccalaureate degree, I don't know. And he's currently a loan officer for a credit union in Dallas. He got enough business hours, I guess, to qualify for that. So there weren't any expectations about going to college. I guess we always knew that there wasn't any money to pay college tuition. So in Texas, you didn't have to pay to go to public school. It was free. Well, I guess that's probably true in most places. But even college tuition in Texas was relatively cheap. But, you know, I guess we just realized that that was never put into the budget, that if we wanted to go to college, then we'd work it on our own. And it actually wasn't until my senior year in high school that I began to think about college. But it wasn't because I wanted to go to college to learn. It was because I wanted to go to college to play basketball.
Okay.
So I had a reasonable amount of skill as a basketball player, which isn't saying much for Texas. Now, we're not talking about Indiana, you know. But still, I mean, they have to play. The colleges have to field basketball teams in Texas, and they do it primarily from drawing upon the high schools. So I wanted to continue to play basketball. And the next logical place to do that was in college. So, and I was fortunate to be recruited by some colleges, not major ones. So I went to college primarily to play basketball. And I would have never gone to college if it had been for basketball. There's just no question about it. I took a basketball scholarship at Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas. That's in East Texas, over close to Louisiana border. And then, interestingly, because I still had a pretty good high school grades, I can't remember what I made on the SATs and the ACTs, that I was also offered a scholarship, basketball scholarship at Rice University, which is an excellent school, perhaps the best school overall, highest standard school in Texas. But my mental thoughts at that time was that it was going to require a great deal of effort for me to stay up in the classroom and rise. And that would distract from the other things that I was interested in, like basketball and whatever else was happening to boys between the ages of 17 and 22. So Stephen F. Austin looked like a good common ground to get a college education, albeit probably not at the same level as Rice, but yet enjoy playing basketball. So, and I often thought about that. I've often thought about that decision in retrospect. What would I be if I'd gone to Rice and I majored in chemistry, as it turned out, versus going to Stephen F. Austin. And because I've been very fortunate in my professional career, I don't think I'd be any better off. So I don't regret making that mistake. And I did. There was a close friend of mine in high school who we played basketball together, although he also played football, and he went to Rice on a football scholarship, and we stayed in contact all the time we were in college together. And it really changed him. I'm not sure, and I thought, I would think, was I going to turn out to be like, I won't mention this guy's name, but people who read this will probably figure out who it is anyway. There weren't many of us in our high school that went to college, much less Rice University. So I don't regret going for those two reasons.
Yeah. Well, one thing the listener won't be able to pick up is your height. And how tall are you? You must be 6'5", 6'6"?
Well, I'm 6'4".
6'4", okay.
Yeah, and I probably shrunk a little bit as I get older, Yeah. I was closer to
6'5". Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But as I said, my brother's 6'7", so he dwarfs me still. That's probably one reason why I'm a better basketball player, because I always had to play against him.
And he didn't think about going to college on a basketball.
No, he didn't. He didn't play basketball at an organized all through middle school and all through junior high and high school like I did. He had other thoughts. He was a little bit more clumsy and not as coordinated and as agile as I did. So.
And when you went off to college, where was this? You did have this role model who was, you said that was the chemistry instructor at your high school,
mm-hmm.
as well as the basketball coach. And usually those, history gets a bad name because the basketball coach is a history instructor too. And it usually doesn't work out that well. But where, how much did this influence kind of your athletic, but also your academic kind of decisions when you did start off to college?
I guess it influenced it to some extent, but not as much as it could have. So he was the assistant basketball coach, wasn't the head coach. And by the time, so I took chemistry when I was a sophomore, so I had this time junior and senior year to kind of develop other interests or maybe other role models. And his influence on me wasn't as great by the time I got to college as it was, say, in the early years I was in high school. So, but nevertheless, when I went to college, I didn't know what I was going to major in besides basketball. And when it came time to declare, then all I just said was science. But then I began to lean towards chemistry because I maybe subconsciously was reflecting back on his influence and his mentoring, so to speak. So I never had much contact with him after I left high school, with the exception that much later on, then he, like a lot of coaches, moved into administration and became a principal at another school. And it just so happened that he was principal at a school in which my best friend in college became a teacher. So Miles, who was another basketball player, and he and I roomed together for 2 years in college, moved from when he left Stephen F. Austin, he with a teaching degree, then he moved to Dallas and took a job in Dallas Independent School District. And lo and behold, the first school he landed was where Ken Beshear was the principal. So we had contact kind of occasionally through there, and it pleased him to see me still involved with science. I could tell he'd always ask about that. And then when Miles left the school where Mr. Beshear was at, then we lost all contact. And I think my brother, several years ago, read his obituary in the newspaper, so he's no longer around.
Okay, let me flip this over.